Hi, I'm Kathy. I'm an alcoholic. First of all, I'd like to thank Neil for asking me to speak. It's always a challenge, and it ends up to be a spiritual experience every time I do it. When I was newly sober, my first sponsor said that you cannot refuse an AA request, and that was a few years ago, and I still believe it, so here I am. I'd like to explain, maybe some of you saw the flyer with the name Buffy on it. Well, I was a flight attendant, and when I moved up here, there was a fellow at Early Birds who found out I was a flight attendant, and I was pouring coffee, and the next thing I know, he goes, Buffy, I'd like coffee, Buffy, I'd like coffee, and that's what started it. That's the nickname. And then somebody over at Sun's found a newspaper article with a picture of a nun on it, and her name was Sister Mary Buffy. And so they put that up on the wall at Sun's Cafe. So the name Buffy has stuck with me. I'm going to talk about my experience, strength, and hope with you in order that you get to know me a little bit better so you can kind of understand my story of recovery. And I want to start on page 33 in the big book because this is what I identify with. It says, to be gravely affected, one does not necessarily have to drink a long time nor take quantities. Some of us have. This is particularly true of women. Potential female alcoholics often turn into the real thing and are gone beyond recall in a few years. And that is my story. So a little bit of background. I grew up in Wisconsin and Indiana in a very, very middle class family, highly educated. My parents believed in higher education. My dad, in the 30s, went to MIT. He was an electrical engineer, and he worked on the atom bomb during World War II. Whatever that means, I don't know, but that's my family. My mother was a nurse and became a nursing instructor. There were four kids and all brainiacs, and then there was Kathy. And I don't know if anybody can identify, but I can tell you I never felt I belonged in that family. I felt I was different. They were bright. I remember coming home with a report card, and Mother would say, John, what a wonderful report card. Ruthann, it's beautiful. Marie, what a great report card. And she'd come over to me, and she'd pat me on the shoulder and say, that's okay, Kathy. And was my mother a mean person? No. She just wanted, I was the one that didn't get the good grades, you know, and she just wanted to make me feel comfortable. But as a kid, I decided that my great mind knew what she really meant. She meant that I couldn't do any better. Just do the best you can and, you know, plug through life. That's what I felt like. My parents sent all four of us through college because that was important to them. But when I was in high school, my dad took me out to the Terre Haute International Airport, and I watched TWA Constellations landing. And as a teenager, I just went, wow. It was in the day when people got dressed up and women had their little makeup cases they'd walk onto the airplane with. I'm dating myself. Some of you have no clue what I'm talking about, and some of you do. But I just thought it was the most wonderful thing. They were getting on and going to exotic places. Probably Cleveland, but what about it? It looked wonderful to me. So I told my dad in high school I wanted to be a flight attendant. Excuse me, stewardess in those days. And my dad said, okay, go to college, get your degree, then get it out of your system. I flew for 26 years. Yes. Anyway, so when my senior year of college, I went to St. Olaf College, a small Lutheran college in southern Minnesota. And my senior year, I started applying to the airlines. Now, this is in the 60s, and in that day, when you got a college degree where I came from in Minnesota, you either became a teacher or a nurse. Those were your options. And I said, I don't think so. So the airline is what I did. I started applying my senior year, and I graduated in May, and by the middle of June, I was down in Kansas City at our training center. I love flying. I love everything about it. I was just meant to do this, and I loved it. 1 year after I started flying, I married my college sweetheart, and he was in the seminary in Berkeley, California. So I moved out to California, flew out of San Francisco. If you can imagine what Berkeley was like in the 60s, some of us were there. It was wonderful and wild and terrific. So he finished seminary, and our first church was in Hollywood, and then we went to Chicago, and then back to California. And we ended up in Alameda, and that's where we bought our first house outside of San Francisco. So I want to talk about my divorce and one of the great regrets of my life. Rodney and I were married 7 years, and the last year of our marriage, he decided he wanted to go back to school and become a crisis counselor. He didn't want to be in the parish anymore. He wanted to get out of that part of the church and become work in a hospital. And death and dying counseling was his specialty. So we went back to school, and here I am, 6 years into the marriage. This is how naive I was. I didn't know. I thought that every time the man of your life walked into a room, your heart would flutter, your stomach would do flip-flops, and you'd take your breath away. This is 6 years into the marriage, and I thought, something's wrong. I don't love this man anymore. It wasn't happening. And I really thought, I'm not in love. And what the problem for me was that he'd come home and talk about crisis counseling, about people dying of pot cancer, lung transplants, alcoholics, all kinds of stuff that he was dealing with. And I thought my silly little problem of my marriage falling apart, I mean, it didn't even qualify for discussion. In that last year of our marriage, I was flying on a trip, and this pilot walked up to me and he said, "Kathy, you are beautiful." And really? And we carried on a torrid, wonderful affair for 3 months. After 3 months, I couldn't stand it anymore. I'm married to a Lutheran minister for and I had the guilt. And you know, and I was raised in the church. I mean, I knew this was not what I was supposed to be doing. So after 3 months, I went home. I said, "I don't love you anymore. I'm leaving and getting divorced." And I walked out of that house. That's the last I've ever heard from that man or talked to that man. And he stood there with his mouth hanging open. So my pilot and I were married for 7 years, go figure. And we had lots of money, and we built a house in Carmel, California. 10 acres, I designed it, it was built, it was fabulous. And during that period of time, we said to my parents, who had retired and moved to San Diego, "If you give us all of your savings, all of your money, we will build you a guest house and we will take care of you for the rest of your life." So my parents, being like me, trusting, gave us all of their money. We built them a guest house. My dad helped us build the houses there. 7 years into the marriage, my husband came home and he said, "I don't love you anymore and I'm getting a divorce." And I stood there with my mouth hanging open as he walked out the door. That is the day I became an alcoholic. It was September of 1982. I had had this wonderful life, basically did what I wanted to, never a problem, major problem. Okay, I wasn't chosen for the football team, you know, or whatever. But, you know, no big trauma in my life. And I didn't know what to do. My head started spinning. I couldn't breathe. I was having a major panic attack. And I called my best friend in Carmel and I said, "Barbara, I think I'm going crazy. I don't know what to do." She said, "Get over here." She said, "Sit down, I'm gonna give you a joint." And I smoked this whatever, and nothing, absolutely nothing. She said, "Let me get the brandy out." She got the brandy out. Now, I'm not an alcoholic. I mean, I could take it or leave it. She got the brandy bottle out, I took a drink. And I don't remember a sober day in 5 years. It worked. I stopped spinning. The pain didn't go away, but I could put a conscious thought together and I wasn't freaking out. Alcohol was my solution. I needed it. I couldn't sleep without it. I'm still working and flying. The next day, I lose track of time from that night and starting the alcohol to what happened, but the next day or so, I got a telephone call from a pilot and he said, "Kathy, get a lawyer. I'm Ron's best friend, but he's been living with another flight attendant for 2 years in St. Louis." Yeah. And I said, "What?" So I asked somebody, "Who do I talk to?" They got me a lawyer. I said, "My name is Kathy Cunningham. I don't know if I'm married or divorced. I have no clue what's going on." And I left on a flight. I got home and I went to his office. He said, "You better sit down." He said, "You have signed everything you own over to Ron. You are divorced. The house, the property, the bank accounts, you do not have a penny." And during that period of time, the sheriff appeared on the property and handed my parents an eviction notice and told my parents to get off of Ron Cunningham's land. They're in the late 70s then. They had no money. I mean, that was it. I mean, we had it all. I was a bit upset. So we went through a lot of trials during that period of time. I don't remember a sober time. I was still flying, and what I would do is I needed that bottle next to the bed so I could sleep, and then toward the end, I needed it. I kept waking up at 2 o'clock for some reason, so I'd need a little more. And I don't remember, I wasn't out in bars, I wasn't doing anything like that. It was just on layovers, I had to have a lot of liquor in the room so I could sleep. Then I'd get up in the morning and have my basic 18 cups of coffee and go and go and go. During that period, toward the end of that 5 year run, I was teaching at our training center in Kansas City, and my boss said, "You know, if you can keep it under control, she's really a great teacher." We had a staff meeting, and they were introducing a new airplane and a new liquor and dinner service. In those days, they used to serve food on an airplane. And so they were explaining, my boss is explaining the service. Okay, A2 goes over there, take the liquor card, and and then you come down the aisle, then B3 goes. And I stood up, I said, "This is the most fucked up service I've ever seen. We don't want to do it. There's not a flight attendant flying who's going to want to do this screwy service. Who the fuck do you all think you are?" And they're sitting there with their mouths hanging. This is a staff meeting. I walk out of the room, down the hall, and my boss comes after me, and she stops me. And she said, "Kathy, you're dying, aren't you?" I just started bawling. I thought I had it together. I was wearing designer clothes, 4-inch hooker heels. I looked great. And I was jello on the inside. I was absolute mush. She has later told me that she grew up in, my supervisor, she grew up in Taos, New Mexico, and her dad was a physician. She did a lot of work in Indian ashrams and all that woo-woo stuff. And she said she was told that she would not be a healer. Her gift in life is that she knew when people needed healing and she could direct them to healing. It was within that week she had me in a treatment center in California. I was in Kansas City. I don't remember going there. I don't remember much about it. It was in Dana Point, California, University of California Hospital, Irvine. I went in there, and I'm going to read this because this is how I entered the treatment center, and it's in Bill's story. "No words can tell of the loneliness and despair I found in that bitter morass of self-pity. Quicksand stretched around me in all directions. I had met my match. I had been overwhelmed. alcohol was my master. I went into that treatment center and I did not care if I lived or died. I did not. That's as close to death as I ever want to come. I was done. I knew that I would either die in there or something would change. Therapist had told me before I went in there, he said, I'm going to tell you a couple things. It's going to be painful. I want you to work hard and you don't want to do it again. And I heard that. I went into that treatment center in their psych unit for depression. I was there for a month and then they transferred me over to chemical dependency, did an evaluation, and they kept telling them, yes, of course I drank every day, but that was just so I could sleep. I never blacked out. And they said, Kathy, that was blacking out. You drank to black out. I said, oh, well, maybe. And so that was, that's part of the strength part of my story. I am grateful beyond measure that I was with a company and I was in a position where they took me bodily and put me on an airplane and got me to a treatment center. I needed a timeout. I never knew I was an alcoholic. I never tried to stop drinking. My problem was the world around me. I just couldn't figure it out anymore. And what happened in that treatment center that changed my life was at the end of that 8 weeks, toward the end, and I don't share this with a lot of people, but since I'm speaking, you know you're it. We did a creative visualization. You have to understand I'm an artist, right? And boy, do I get into visualizations. Now here's a room with 20 giggling alcoholics, you can imagine. We're gonna do a creative visualization. Giggle, giggle, ha, ha, ha. And Kathy's like, and I close my eyes. And the visualization is this, it's 20 minutes. She's gonna count it down. It's the end of the world. You know, you've got 19 minutes. Now you're on a playground. I want you to invite anybody to that playground that you need to finish business with because the world's coming to an end. You have 17 minutes. And it went on and on, and I'm getting into this. I mean, I have people on that playground. I'm talking to people. I am so in this. And she's still counting down. We're doing a lot of different things. About the last 5 minutes, she said, now you are in a bunker, and I want you to visualize anything you want to visualize because the world is coming to an end in 5 minutes, 4 minutes. She's counting down. And what happened, I was in a concrete bunker in a corner and an incredible white light filled that room. It was blinding and I knew that was God. And a robed figure came in and out of that. I do not know if it was Jesus, Buddha, Muhammad, Bill Walsh, I don't know. I don't know, but I knew it was a prophet, and I knew it was a teacher. Well, okay, it wasn't Bill Walsh. And then there was a dove that would go in and out of this. And for me, that was the connection between the God and the everything and man. And I was so peaceful and so happy and felt there was something to life. And of course then it ends and she said, oh, the world didn't come to an end, the door to the bunker is open, now you can leave. And I walked out into this beautiful bright field of yellow flowers and trees on one side. And when I get terribly upset or something really upsets me today, I can still go to that field. That is what happened to me in treatment. That was my psychic change. From that moment on, I knew there was hope. I wanted to live. I didn't know what was going to happen, but I knew that something inside of me has changed. And I will say this, that was only the beginning. I knew that that wasn't it. That was just the beginning of it. I was living in Missouri at the time, and I left that treatment center in this little town of St. Charles. And I walked down that dark alley in St. Charles, Missouri to my first smoke-filled room meeting. And I went up there and sat at a table, and this man next to me put his arm around me and he said, "Kathy, you will never be alone again." And I started bawling. How did he know about that god-awful loneliness? I thought that was just me. I figured you all had it figured out. I was the one that had to catch up because I didn't get it. And now I know, being sober for a while, it is not only the fellowship and being in those rooms. It is that God that's without and within. That's why I'm not alone anymore. I got a sponsor right away. 90 meetings in 90 days, got a book. I was afraid not to. I didn't know. I wanted to hold on to whatever this was. My first sponsor, this is how well I was. I picked out this gal after a couple meetings because she was beautiful and she was thin. Priority number one. She was a hooker. Priority number two. No. She had been a hooker and lived on the streets of St. Louis. And I knew she would not put up with my bullshit. I knew that. I looked at her. It was my way or the highway, and I needed that. I grew up in a family where my mother could pound and passive aggressive, and I'm so sad, and I'm so lonely, and And she said, when I pulled that at a meeting, she said, "Snap out of it. You do not get to act like that in the meeting. If you need somebody to talk to you or help you, you have to ask them." And I went, whoa. You know, I get a lot of attention the other way. So I had to stop that. I worked the steps with her. And the fourth and fifth step were very difficult for me. I didn't have a lot of baggage to deal with. I got sober in May. In March, she said, "You will be at my house March 12th with your fourth step." I had spent, I'm not exaggerating, months asking people, "I don't get the chart. I don't understand. Mr. Jones, Mrs. Jones, I was in London at a meeting, so I had my book. Can anybody explain this chart to me?" No, just do it. And they didn't have Joe and Charlie tapes back then, folks. I'm sorry, this was in the 80s. And, you know, what Father Martin was as good as we got, and that was wonderful. But it just, read the book, figure it out, do it. And so what I did is I wrote my life story, which Joe and Charlie would say, "You don't do that." But that's what I did. And for me, the fourth and fifth step was more of a deal of finding humility. I am such a perfectionist, don't you know, that if I look right and I act right and I say the right things, then you've got to like me because I got my crap together. And I wanted it to be so perfect that they would publish it in the grapevine as this incredible example. But I knew when I took my little story to her that she would get out the red marking pen and start correcting my punctuation. I'm a college graduate who can't spell. You know, and I knew there'd be lines here, and I knew she would say, "Take it home, do it again. This is not even close to what you need to do." But she didn't, and we sat and we talked, and it was the humility I had, no matter what, I was gonna do it. I had to get that perfectionism out of myself and just do it anyway. And so that's what I did. Now I wanna talk about the life as it is today, and some of the hope that I've had in this program. Since I was single 2 years when somebody introduced my current husband to me, husband number three, and I started getting all these things from friends. You've got to meet Bill King. He's a wonderful guy, great guy. He was getting the same things from other mutual friends. So one day, I was living in Wilmington, North Carolina, and commuting to St. Louis to fly, and he was living in LA, and he called and he said, "Hi, this is Bill King." I said, "Oh yeah, the guy I'm supposed to marry, how are you doing?" And he started laughing, and I said, "Yeah, do you want to get this over with?" And he said, "Yeah, why don't we meet someplace?" And you know, he thought I was living in Wilmington, California. He had no idea I was in North Carolina, and he thought Wilmington, California was far away. So he was out on business trip, and you know, flying was no big deal. So we met in Denver, Colorado, and it was awful. I don't know if you like first dates. I don't. "Hi, how are you? Have any children?" It was awful. It was so awful. Got back to the hotel. We were in Denver, and he said, "I've got a rental car for the weekend. You want to drive to Pikes Peak tomorrow?" And I said, "Sure." So we got in the car, and it's, I think, about an hour down to Manitou Springs or so from Denver. And we're just talking, just stuff. You know, what do you do? What do you like? And these things came out. We both liked the Oakland Raiders. They were in LA at the time. Oakland Raiders. I've always had an Airedale, love Airedales. My husband wanted to collect carousel horses, and my favorite artist was Ben Shahn, little-known Jewish artist. We get to this bed and breakfast. Two Airedales come bounding out of the front door. The owners are in Oakland Raider t-shirts. There's a carousel horse on the dining room table and a Ben Shahn poster in the living room. And I'm going, oh man, wow. So we had a wonderful time, went up to Pikes Peak and had dinner and just had a great time. So back to the airport on Sunday, I go home, he goes home. Monday morning, he calls Kathy. I love you, I want to marry you. I've never been so sure about anything in my life. And I said, Bill who? That was in August, and we were married in November. And this man is a gift from God. I know that. I mean, I just am convinced. Since we've been here, my dad died 2/22/02. Being a scientist, he picked a great day. Thank you, Dad. And when my mom and dad moved out here, and they were having dinner, and my mom called and she said, Kathy, your dad just fell over at the dining room table, and I've called the paramedics. I got there, and standing, kneeling over my dad was Dennis Kettle. He was in the program, a fireman, and he looked up at me and he just went like that. And I, you know, thank you, God, for having Dennis there, you know, during that time. 2 years later, my sister, who's the other alcoholic in our family, had a massive heart attack, brain dead, and my mother and I had to go down to Los Angeles and pull my sister off a respirator. So if you think you're not hurting anybody but yourself, you selfish little witch. Yes. You are killing people. My mother had to make a decision to kill her daughter. And it was extremely difficult. And let me say this about that. My sister did not want to get sober. Her attitude was, you die anyway. And I finally stopped talking to her about recovery. Because what she was hearing from me is, I didn't love her because she was a drunk. And I gave all that up, and I just would say, Ruthanne, I really love you. I loved my sister till the day she died, and I still do. I hate the disease. For me, there's a huge difference. My sister was my friend. She was sick, and she could not get sober. Then my mom was living here, and she was pretty frail, and living in a senior apartment building, and she kept falling. And she fell about three times in a couple months. And the last time she fell in her apartment, she fell at 9 o'clock at night. It took her till midnight to crawl to the telephone and call the paramedics. 3 hours on the floor trying to get help. And I walked in, and she just looked at me. She said, this is it, isn't it, Kathy? And I said, yeah, Mom. You know, I'm so grateful you didn't fall and hit your head and die in this room. And so, you know, a nursing home don't like people who fall. So if she would have gone to a nursing home, they would have insisted on bed rest. My mother was not ready. She was a little dynamo in her walker, let me tell you. As long as it had a coffee cup holder, my mom was good. So I talked to my husband, and my mother moved in with us the last 3 years of her life. She died when she was 95, and I was with her at the moment she died. And when before that, I have to digress just a little bit, because this is so important. This is the program. I had mentioned in the meeting when my mom was going to have some surgery, and that I was scared because she was older. And I got to the hospital, and Cleve and Don Wilkes were sitting there. They just sat with me. That's the program of Alcoholics Anonymous. So my mother, I asked Bill what we should do, and he said, well, let's move Mom in here. My mother and Bill got along a lot better than I got with my mother. They would talk for hours, and I'm a flitter. I'm up, I'm doing laundry. And they're just sitting, having a great time. It was wonderful. The day that my mom died, I called Teresa and Paula, and they came over, and Teresa said, Kathy, I just saw your mother's soul leave your house. That's the program of Alcoholics Anonymous. That's all I've ever wanted, was to be heard, to be a part of life. And when I was putting this together, I wanted to read something out of the book or put an ending to the story. And when I was meditating about this, what should I end this with? I realized there is no end to this story. You know, our journey goes on and on. I do not want to stop growing spiritually. I want to be there. I do not want to lead you on your path. I want to stand beside you on your path. I can't thank you enough. And I'm standing here thinking about some people that have been so impressive in my life in this program. Jack Ballard, my first sponsor, Nancy Nave, Herschel, Ole, Jim Fisher, Don Wilkes, Cleve, people that I have met on this journey that will always be part of my life. Bill and I are getting older, and we're starting to have some physical challenges, I'll call them. But you know, it's okay, it's part of the aging process. You know, my husband wanted to come tonight, and he got sick this afternoon, couldn't come. So we just do what we can do. You are my family, my friends, and I can't tell you what a blessing recovery has been for me. Thank you for letting me share.